This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We may be watching the rapid breakdown of all civil society in Venezuela. At the beginning of a week, with international institutions saying there are more refugees in the world right now than at any time since World War II, the Western Hemisphere may be poised to add significantly to the 65 million total displaced people in the world. More about the scale of the refugee crisis this hour, we will speak with someone whose job it is to welcome people into the U.S. in Texas, someone who is a refugee himself from the Horn of Africa. But first, we take you to the streets of Caracas, Venezuela, the once prosperous oil producer. The nation that was selling discounted oil to U.S. consumers just 6 years ago is slipping into a chaos that looks more and more like Somalia. There were more than 50 mostly food riots in the last 2 weeks alone. Venezuela's inability to feed itself has crippled the country's most basic functions, including its education system. Venezuela's 7 million public school students have probably missed 40% of their school year because teachers are absent, waiting in line for food on their specific government-designated day, or worse, they've just gone missing or have been killed. Joining me now is Hannah Dreyer, an Associated Press correspondent in Caracas. Welcome, Hannah.
Good to be with you, John.
So what does it feel like to see this crumbling of civil society that's going on in Venezuela?
I really can't believe it. It feels like just in the past couple months, things have gotten so much worse here. There's been a slow decline for years, but now we're seeing food riots daily. I leave my house and people are trying to pick the wild mangoes on the trees just to have something to eat for breakfast. There aren't cars on the streets anymore because there are no car parts and nobody's working anyway. It just feels like a totally different country and one where absolutely nothing is working.
What's the way out of this? Is there any way out of this? Is there some sort of international involvement that will halt this slide?
I mean, what we're seeing right now is really the start of a humanitarian crisis. And what's so strange and so unique to Venezuela is that they won't take any international aid. So I have people, readers, who write to me who ask, how can I help? I really want to do something, just give some money, give some food to these people. And the truth is they can't because all of that kind of help is prohibited. So you can't give these people medicine. You can't give people food. You can't even just give people $100, which would make a huge difference in anybody's life here. All of that is banned.
And what about the transportation system? I mean, can people come in and out of the country? Are the borders being enforced? Is there a refugee crisis that may begin if this gets much worse?
Venezuela right now feels like an island on land. Most of the border here is with Colombia, and the government shut that down almost a year ago. And you hear stories almost daily now of people drowning, trying to cross through the river, people who are dying on the bridge that they let some very sick people use to walk between the two countries. And airlines are also fleeing the country. Right now, it's very hard to get a flight out. One of my flights was canceled recently, and I had to wait a full day to find another one that could take me out of the country. So it's very isolated. And people who want to leave can't because they don't have the money to buy a plane ticket. And almost everyone I know wants to leave.
What is the state of the press corps, the international press corps? It must be dwindling, or I suppose it could be growing, depending upon the way this crisis is being viewed. You don't see the Venezuelan headlines dominating coverage outside of the country.
Reporting has definitely gotten harder here. I recently had a group of armed gangs tell me that I needed to leave the neighborhood because I was a gringo imperialist. It can feel threatening, and there are also some issues with getting people accredited. You know, the life of a foreign correspondent here is so much easier compared to everybody else's. It's hard to really complain.
Although that also could put you at risk in the sense that you were a target because of the ease with which you can move around the country. What about the communication system that is the lifeline for you getting your reports out?
Physically getting the information from Venezuela to other countries has gotten very hard. There's no international calling anymore. So if something happens, I can't just call up my editors. And it also means that if you're a Venezuelan, a lot of people have family in Colombia, in the United States, and you can't make those calls anymore. We have rolling power outages, so sometimes you can't get on the internet. You're trying to write a story in the dark. It's a complicated place to report, but especially lately, it feels so important to try to communicate the disaster unfolding here.
All right, then, Hannah, before we go, what's your day like today? What do you plan to try to figure out in terms of coverage? And what do you have to do between, point A and B to get that accomplished?
Well, the news of today is that we're getting the next step in a process to recall the president. The organized political opposition here has made it its goal for this year to let people vote on whether they want to throw President Nicolas Maduro out or not. And polls show that a big majority of Venezuelans want him gone, but it's very unlikely that the administration is going to let that vote go ahead. So today we have people who have to go and give their fingerprints to administrators to prove that they really do want to sign this petition to recall the president. At the same time, we have thugs who've taken over the country's largest beer distributor. I want to go and check that out, but it's in a dangerous neighborhood, so I have to decide how to go there safely. And we also have, I'm sure, some food protests that will get in the way of all of that planned reporting.
If those stories don't pan out, you could focus on the 7 million public school students who have yet another day off.
That's right. The school situation here is so sad because that was really one of the crown jewels of the socialist revolution. And for years, schools were getting better and better. It seemed like people really might escape poverty. But now the estimates are that 40% of teachers a day aren't showing up. They're in food lines, they're trying to make their own lives work. And so you have these kids who risk their lives to get through the slums and get to their schools. And they show up, and it's like an all-day lunch hour. They're just hanging out, waiting for somebody to come and teach them. And more days than not, they're missing classes.
Hannah Dreyer, AP correspondent in Caracas. Thanks so much, Hannah. And, watch yourself.
Trying.
We'll talk to you
Thanks,
again.
John.
So far this year, the U.S. has admitted 40,000 refugees from all over the world, including Myanmar, Somalia, and Iraq. Johannes Bachta is the director of the Casa de Raices, an emergency shelter for refugees in San Antonio, Texas. He came to the U.S. in 2009 as a refugee from Eritrea and is now an American citizen. Johannes says he's worried that refugees from Venezuela may be making their way north.
That is the expectation, as everything that has happening in Central America, we do expect everyone. Sometimes we do see people from Brazil as well. So Venezuela is any, it is not any more different than any other Latin American countries. Yes, we do expect them.
Who are the people that you mostly serve there at Casa de Raíces?
Yes, unfortunately, when people think about refugees, they think about refugees from Africa, maybe Pakistan, Middle East, and all that. But the truth is, refugees could be from anywhere. And at my workplace, I do see mostly mothers and children who are seeking protection in the United States. They're all from Central America. I can say that 98% of people that we serve at Casa de Raíces, they are mothers and children from Central America. They could be from Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and all the other countries as well.
Which underscores that this is absolutely a global problem. As someone who's come from Eritrea and had a very difficult time getting to the United States and to receive asylum, do you feel solidarity with the refugees that you serve at Casa de Raíces?
Absolutely, yes. It is. I see myself when I first got into the US and I was undocumented until I get asylum because then there was court proceedings. That is, these people are in the same situation. They are undocumented until they get through the court proceedings and get asylum. So I see myself in them and I do feel that they need an absolutely immediate help and be received as the refugees.
And this is a nation of 60 million people without a state, with different languages, different flags, different affiliations, national affiliations. But ultimately, the ways in which refugees are not being dealt with, these are permanent situations. Nobody's going home. And so, who is in this nation? I mean, what are we to say about this nation of 60 million people without a flag?
It is difficult. Actually, we do have to think about human beings. We don't have to think about flags, borders, or nations or countries. We have to think about the single human being. If we are seeing that into those people, if I see a person instead of a person from Honduras or a person from other country, from Africa, from Eritrea, then we would be welcoming them. But if we do see people with flags, if we see people with different cultures and all that, then we are limited to just say, no, these aren't from this country. We cannot have them. They have to go back.
What was it like for you to be in limbo for the amount of time that you were without papers and not knowing how things would turn out?
When I traveled to the U.S., I had a hope. Every refugee had hope when they are traveling to a better place. That is what I was expecting. But then when I came here and I was in limbo, it was desperation, definitely, because I couldn't find a job. I knew that I had a skill, or even though I was able to find a job, I couldn't work because it was illegal to work, or there wasn't anyone willing to hire me, or there wasn't any way that I can rent an apartment. I couldn't drive. It was so desperate.
Johannes Bachta is director of the Casa de Raíces Emergency Shelter. Today is World Refugee Day. Hashtag with refugees. That's a way of getting involved online. The United Nations is trying to mobilize the international community to put aside local politics and to try and focus on resettlement of the more than 65 million displaced people. The U.S. has pledged to resettle 85,000 refugees from around the world this year. We're about 14th when compared with other countries. And in raw numbers, Turkey hosted more refugees than any other country in 2014, a huge 1.6 million, mostly from Syria. Anti-refugee sentiment is not new, nor is it limited to certain parts of the globe. Americans have had vastly different levels of enthusiasm for immigrant waves down through history. Betsy Fisher joins us from Minneapolis, policy director of the International Refugee Assistance Project at the Urban Justice Center. Betsy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
First of all, what is the state of anti-refugee sentiment, would you say, in this 65 million person crisis, which has been noted many times is more refugees than were displaced from World War II?
Sure. I think there's a significant movement towards nativism and xenophobia at the same time that there's record numbers of displaced people. Here in the United States, the Refugee Resettlement Program and our history of providing asylum for people fleeing fleeing persecution has been a broad bipartisan program. It's been a program that has had support from people across the aisle and across the political spectrum because this is what our country is built on, the idea that we can provide a safe haven for people who are fleeing harm. And we're hopeful that we'll be able to return to that kind of bipartisan support in the future.
When you say return to it, would you say that the rhetoric of the 2016 campaign has threatened that bipartisanship and the programs that came out of it to deal with refugees coming into the United States right now?
I think we still see support from people across the aisles on both sides of the political parties. But certainly what we've seen is damaging rhetoric and harmful rhetoric towards the people who are coming to our country simply because they want to build a future and to live in a place where they can build an education and find jobs for themselves and their children.
What has been the historical record of the United States in welcoming refugees? I mean, I think in raw numbers, we're right up there at the top. But in terms of assimilation and the political consequences of that assimilation, we're still dealing with some issues, even going back to the Irish migration in the early part of the 1900s.
Yeah, at every point in history, there's been, I think, a population that's been targeted or feared. And with time, we've seen that every one of those waves has been integrated and has become an essential part of the American fabric. in terms of integration of refugees, every refugee who enters the United States is provided with assistance from one of nine agencies that contracts with the federal government to provide services like English lessons and helping kids get enrolled in school. And with that assistance, refugees are able to become taxpaying individuals, to become economically productive very, very rapidly. And we see from a recent study, an empirical study put out by the Migration Policy Institute, we know that refugee men actually work at higher levels than native-born U.S. citizens, and refugee women work at levels equal to that of native-born U.S. women. So in terms of economic integration and, you know, the historical integration of immigrants over time, I think our country has done remarkably well.
Although time in the crisis bears directly on the ability of families to integrate. When you have limited loss in education in Venezuela resulting in what's being called a lost generation among school children in that country, and then you've got 4 years of no education for millions of students in Syria, if there is a resettlement, it's going to be more and more difficult. Is it likely that any of the Syrian refugees that you're seeing will resettle, will go home, will have any of the outcomes that we saw after World War II?
It's impossible to say if any of the Syrian refugees will be able to return. Certainly, we don't see positive movement in Syria to that direction. What we can say about Syrian refugees is that this is a group of people who have been remarkably well educated prior to the crisis. The refugees living in countries like Turkey and Jordan, who could possibly be resettled to a place like the United States. Many of them are engineers, doctors, teachers, very highly educated people who, with time, would be able to be, very crucial members to the American community. In terms of lost education, that's certainly a serious factor. But we've seen refugees fleeing many conflicts have had that that disadvantage of having missed out on years of education. And these are individuals who are survivors. They voted with their feet to flee violence and terrorism. And given the chance to build a future, I think they'll do remarkably well.
Talk about the institutions that have emerged in the United States in the wake of our inability to advance refugee and immigration reform. The detention of refugees, independent of refugee camps, actual detention. What does that mean, and how likely is that to continue?
Yeah, detention of individuals in the United States is unfortunately an entrenched part of immigration law. It certainly is harmful for the individuals who are being detained because they don't have the ability to begin studying English. They don't have the ability to put their skills or their training to work, and they're separated from their families. And then in terms of what that does for the United States, it's obviously a tremendous drain on resources to be keeping these people in detention, especially when these individuals are here for the purpose of claiming asylum. It's unnecessary, and it's certainly a practice that should be reformed.
Well, hoping for immigration reform as a way of dealing with the refugee crisis in the United States, which has a pretty good track record on dealing with refugees, noting all of this on World Refugee Day, which is a way of underscoring 65 million people displaced in the world today, according to international sources. Betsy Fisher is policy director at the International Refugee Assistance Project at the Urban Justice Center. She spoke with us from Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you, Betsy.
Thanks, John.
Curry fires a three. He missed it. Loose ball tip. Grabbed by Spates. Spates fires. And this one is over. Believe it, Cleveland. Savor it. Soak it in. The kid from Akron has come home. The Cavaliers are NBA champions. And the impossible dream has come true.
There was nothing but joy in the gap-toothed vacant lots of Cleveland, Ohio, to the theater district through downtown and rippling out to LeBron James lovers and haters the world over. The Cleveland Cavaliers became the NBA champs in the final minute of the final quarter of the final game of the final historic best-of-seven series between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the defending champion Golden State Warriors. The Cavaliers, led by Ohio native LeBron James, managed to end a 52-year curse for Cleveland by coming back from a 3-1 game deficit, the first team in history to do so, James was unanimously named Finals MVP after leading the Cavaliers to the first NBA championship in franchise history. Final game held in Oakland, but it didn't stop the party on the streets of Cleveland to watch that final game. Peter Patakos was one of the fans. He's an attorney and Cleveland sports fan and blogger at clevelandfrowns.com.
There was not a single molecule of my existence that believed that the Cavs could win that game until LeBron hit the free throw to put the Cavaliers up by four, even after Kyrie Irving hit the three-pointer with some 30 seconds were left, I suppose. I still didn't believe they were going to win. I just assumed Golden State would hit a three-pointer and that we would have some kind of last-second heartbreak.
And what was amazing was, you know, it was Kyrie Irving with that three. LeBron had a three there late in the fourth quarter. There was, Kevin Love grabbing balls in critical moments of rebounding. And Curry played a dreadful game. And still, you felt like this is absolutely pins and needles on the edge.
Absolutely. It's what the last 52 years has conditioned us for. So
how old are you, Peter?
I'm only 37 myself, but knowing the history.
And it's your whole life.
My whole life. And you know, we've had, it's not just that the teams have lost, it's that they've come so close and lost in just these excruciating ways.
No, I listened to the Tribe lose to Atlanta on my honeymoon in the mid-90s.
Yeah, there you go. That one wasn't so bad. It was 2 years later when we lost to the Marlins when we had the lead in the ninth inning of Game 7. That was the real gut punch. And then the Indians lost again in 2007 to the Red Sox after having a 3-1 series lead.
You can start forgetting these. You can start just pushing these out of your brain. It's all LeBron. It's all Kyrie. It's all Kevin Love.
But part of me doesn't want to forget it. It's interesting. And as happy as everyone is in Cleveland this morning, and as great as it is, especially to me, that LeBron is the one who ended up breaking the so-called curse, the curse was something interesting and special. So we have, in a sense, lost that. Cleveland has just become maybe a slightly less interesting place this morning.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, Peter. That's ridiculous. LeBron worked so hard for this. And, you know, from Akron straight up there to downtown Cleveland, I mean, the place is lit up.
That's what makes it so special is that LeBron is from here and he chose to be here. He chose to come back here and bring a title to his hometown. I don't think it could happen in another way that could mean more in professional sports these days. I mean, you look at it and sometimes you have to wonder, especially as a Cleveland fan over the last, three decades, like, why do we even care so much anymore? What do these people even really have to do with Cleveland other than that they use these brand names that have become associated with the city? But now, the players and coaches aren't really from here anymore. And even the owners aren't from here anymore. Dan Gilbert's from Detroit. Jimmy Haslam, the owner of the Browns, is from Tennessee. These guys are just billionaires who have an investment. And you start to wonder, why do we let ourselves identify with all this losing?
But that's an old story, Peter. Rockefeller started Standard Oil in Cleveland and ran away. And, there's all kinds of money in Cleveland that went elsewhere. The National City Bank in Cleveland was originally a Rockefeller investment. And
that's what makes this so special, is the fact that LeBron is actually from here and someone whose talents came from here and brought his talents back here to do something special for his hometown, his unique talents. And I mean, this was all LeBron. And Dan Gilbert ends up with this title in spite of himself. He issued that letter and called LeBron every name in the book. LeBron came back anyway. LeBron ends up effectively firing the coach that Gilbert hired to keep LeBron under control. David Blatt was criticized for that. LeBron's agents end up getting Tristan Thompson a $90 million deal. And everybody in Cleveland, the Cleveland chattering classes were so upset about that too, all the way to the end. But it ended up being the perfect move. Tristan Thompson, what he was able to do in this series, really, you could say, put the Cavs over the edge. And LeBron came here and built this. This is his team. It's amazing.
Worth every penny. And they're all sobbing there at the end. Did you see that? I mean, LeBron is sobbing. Kyrie Irving is sobbing. Kevin Love is like jumping around with tears streaming down his face. J.R. Smith came apart at the news conference talking about his parents and all the tough times he's been through. It was pretty amazing.
It was beautiful. It really was.
A moment of sympathy for people of the Bay Area, Peter? Do you have Any of that in your heart?
No.
No,
no, I don't. Yeah. I mean, you know, for the kids, I suppose. But they won one last year. They've won championships. They've had the 49ers. They've had the San Francisco Giants in recent years, have been a very good team, have won several World Series. I'm sure that they'll move on.
Well, no matter what happens to that convention, this is the high point of 2016 for Cleveland, right?
I suppose so. Makes me feel a little uncomfortable that we are talking about a basketball game being a high point for a place. What are we doing to make the world a better place, a safer place, a more sustainable place, a more equal place? That would be nice if we could have some achievements on that front. But, you know, it is nice. It is nice to see what LeBron has done. And if anything, what LeBron has done is show that it's the workers who should be in more control of things than they are, maybe.
Peter Patakos is attorney and editor-blogger of Cleveland Frowns. Maybe smiling today, Peter?
Smiling today. I might have to just shut the website down or come up with a new name.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks a lot.
We'll leave you with a little bit of nastiness this hour. The internet has become an emotional wildlife preserve for meanness. I suppose we're not telling you anything new. Where anger, speech that could not survive in face-to-face encounters, and bullying all find a safe zone of anonymity and brashness. Listen to this. How do these mean tweets from trolls to female sports reporters sound when spoken out loud?
So I have to read all of them, right? Because, I mean, I don't...
Read them, I guess.
I hope you get raped again.
Oh.
You need to be hit in the head with a hockey puck and killed.
That's a very small sampling from the hashtag More Than Mean folks. This week, our friends at Retro Report look at the outrage machine, they're calling it. Television, they say, created the first safe zones for mob shaming with the shouting and fighting audiences on daytime shows like Ricky Lake, Maury Povich, Montel Williams, and the Bishop of Meanness himself, Jerry Springer. Those shows, according to Retro Report producer Bonnie Bertram, lead directly to the cruel online attacks on the parents of the 2-year-old boy snatched by an alligator at Disney World.
This happened so soon after that woman whose child got into the gorilla pen at the Cincinnati Zoo, and she was just vilified. But there was a contingent of people who said, wait a minute, this poor mother was doing her best, we shouldn't all pile on. And I thought, oh, great, this is going to be a moment of reset, a moment for everybody to sort of take a pause and say, is this really fair to heap all this sort of judgment and condemnation on this mother? But then here we are, what, 2 weeks later, and the same thing is happening to this family who just lost their son in Orlando.
Is there a history here, and is there a way to tune it out, which probably is what you would want to do if you were this family?
Well, it's interesting. In this Retro Report, we sort of studied where some of the origins of this might have come into play. And we thought about audiences that sort of enjoyed having the sort of moral condemnation, like Jerry Springer. We talked about talk radio and Rush Limbaugh and the sort of level of conversation and accusations that were made. And there is this history, and we even dated it back to the Scarlet Letter.
All the shows tried to be like Oprah.
A lot of people have problems with in-laws who come and don't know how to go home.
Go after middle-aged housewives. And then along came Ricky Lake. And hers was really the first talk show to go after the kids. Young people are much more open about their lifestyles, much wilder. It just struck me as a business model, so we did that.
Let me see if I have this right. You're sleeping with you're having sex with your grandson?
Yes, sir.
And there's Jerry Springer as historian and producer of this kind of predation. And, you know, the Scarlet Letter is the sort of moral code that's from Nathaniel Hawthorne. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the mechanisms of television and the internet take this to a different level.
They absolutely do. I mean, it's almost as though now there's a script, a mechanism that triggers, sometimes usually inadvertently, this whole scenario where people just get made into public enemy number one, and oftentimes really by no fault of their own.
I mean, of course there's no fault of their own, because the extremes of the attack have nothing to do with court, crime, anything that we would associate with traditional justice.
Well, it's interesting, too, when you really look at these things, there's a lot of what I would say sort of identity verification going on. Like with the dentist in Minnesota who killed Cecil the Lion.
Right.
So there are a lot of people who are like, I'm an animal lover, and I'm going to show you my credentials as an animal lover by trashing this guy because of what he did. Now, what he did is hardly defensible. But at the same time, did it really warrant people publishing his home address and saying they were going to kill him, kill his family? There seems to be a sort of limitless acceptance of what's possible.
There's also a cycle of outdoing the previous message, the post. For instance, one could say, oh, I'm so sad that Cecil died. How can you live with yourself, Mr. Dentist? But then the next post has to be, how can you live with yourself? Hey, what if I came over to your house and shot you? Then the next post is, hey, we're going to do that. Here's the address. So that fuels this as much
as
anything.
Yes, it absolutely does. And we talked to this privacy expert named Danielle Citron, who's really an expert in this. And she talks about how that mob mentality and the one-upsmanship that plays out in the comments section or on Facebook or on Twitter is really damaging.
Set up the case of Jennifer Connell as an example of what you're talking about here.
So Jennifer Connell was at her cousin's son's birthday party. And when he saw her from across the lawn, he ran up to greet her. He never hugged her. He ran up to greet her. And she fell over backwards and broke her wrist. The injury required three surgeries. And her cousin had homeowner's insurance. So under Connecticut law, and Connecticut's not alone, I think there are 17 other states that have this policy. If you can't come to terms with the homeowner's insurance policy, you have to name someone in a lawsuit to sort of trigger the whole process of getting the homeowner's insurance to weigh in. So her lawyers said you have to name the child because that's just the way it's going to work. It's a simple case of protocol.
They thought, administrative detail.
Right. So she goes to court. And a reporter who thinks this is going to be, you know, a page four story, no big deal, heard her on the stand. And she's an English major. She has a way with words that's quite descriptive. And so to describe an injury of how it hurt when her hand was bent backwards, she described how it hurt to hold a plate carrying hors d'oeuvres at a cocktail party. So the reporter suddenly doesn't see this as a protocol story about how to get insurance to pay for something. He sees this Upper East Side Manhattanite complaining about the pain of holding a cocktail plate at a party. And suddenly it does become something very different than an insurance lawsuit.
Well, it's a lawsuit that's all in the family.
Oh, listen to this.
The family relative suing a boy over an accident at his birthday party when he turned 8.
She says he broke her wrist, caused her pain and mental anguish.
She claimed that her little nephew gave her a, quote, forceful hug.
Now, this is cable television sort of being the shark feed.
Well, some of that was network news, I have to tell you.
Or, well, television.
It was television. Yes, it was television. But what happened was it was first picked up by a local Connecticut paper in their online edition, and then it spun out into national news and, in fact, even international news. And then suddenly everybody was chiming in online that she was this horrible person and a horrible aunt going after her nephew's money. It was really quite stunning to see.
Among the people that you talk to who kind of track the societal consequences of this sort of thing, how important is this both in terms of the, you know, shaming that we don't see that happens, you know, in middle schools or high schools, and the quickness with which something can become a national scandal and then poof, go away?
Well, the problem is that it doesn't really go away, because if you go to Google and you search Jennifer Connell's name, this will forever be linked with her. It's going to be very hard for her to escape this. So it might cycle through the news cycle and not be on everybody's, you know, not making national news anymore. But online, that trail lasts forever. It's really permanent.
Permanent scars from online predation. Bonnie Bertram took a look at this issue as a producer for Retro Report. Thanks so much.
Sure.
My name is Christina, and I'm calling from South Loop, Chicago. And my ex-boyfriend, who clearly felt jilted by our breakup, chose to shame me online with lies and impersonations. He sent emails to my current partner telling him that I'm promiscuous and untrustworthy. He created a fake Ashley Madison account using my full name, my real phone number and email address. And he's created fake Craigslist ads telling the whole world that I'm looking for a good time. Again, using my name and full email address so that I was getting emails from random men telling me they'd like to meet at Starbucks. And I've shared my story with a lot of other women, and you would be amazed at how common this actually is.
Well, that is the crazy ex story of all time. Ever been shamed by someone online? Ever been shamed at all for any reason? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Pray for Christina. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.